the finance presenter recently, government represented by Mr. Benson Mukunu. The floor is yours. Benson.
Sorry, Chair. Sorry, Chair. I'm just having some very minor technical issues here. Trying to fix them now very quickly. I don't know if I can see myself, so I think you guys can see me.
Yes, we can see you, Mr.
Can I just
Benson.
ask you, Maria, if you're still there, if you're able to flag the presentation on your side? I'm having some issues with sharing. Is that okay?
Okay, I would ask Enrico if you can please slide the presentation on behalf of Ms. Mpumi.
Perfect, perfect, perfect.
Over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Next slide, Enrico.
Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members, colleagues, and members of the public. My name is Benson Tunu, and I was responsible for compiling the submission on the Copyright Amendment Bill on behalf of the Western Cape Government's Department of Economic Development and Tourism, which was the lead department on this particular bill. So the bill was developed over a number of years to bring alignment between South Africa's copyright law, the transition to the digital era, as well as developments at a multilateral level. What we see as a long overdue and necessary amendment of the Act to allow South Africa to comply with international treaties and conventions which require the country's domestic legislation to be consistent with international imperatives. Beyond this, there are a number of competing considerations which require heeding, chief amongst which is, having intellectual property legislation that is cognizant of the need to improve access to key information and learning resources. In light of South Africa's social and economic circumstances within an ever-evolving digital era, whilst also ensuring that, creators and their livelihoods are sufficiently protected from commercial exploitation. Last week, I was able to attend the public hearings organized by the Western Cape Provincial Parliament. I think my main takeaway from that one meeting, as if I wasn't already aware of this, I think my main takeaway was just how polarizing the bill is. I think before even beginning to unpack our submission as a province, it's important to acknowledge that tension, or the tension that exists between, the economic interests of major corporations locally and globally, whose investment into South Africa can't be overlooked, and those of, vulnerable artists who've, who've drawn the short stick historically, having been exploited by a multitude of actors. It's also important to acknowledge the vital social outcomes which the current version of the bill seeks to enable, with proponents of fair and just access to learning resources, lauding the bill as the solution to, historical barriers to education. So, before proceeding with outlining our comments, I think it's just important for us to, remain constantly aware of that tension, and being aware of, how incredibly difficult it is to, get it right with a bill of this nature. That being said, I'll be providing the committee with a brief on our submission on the bill. It's important to note, from the outset that as a department responsible for economic development, while we took into consideration a number of different factors in drafting our comments, we primarily viewed or reviewed the bill from the perspective of its impact on the economy. Next slide, please. One of the predominant concerns, which has loomed large throughout the development of the bill has been the lack of a publicly available regulatory impact, regulatory or socioeconomic impact assessment. As a provincial government, we've required regulatory impact assessments or RIAs to be performed in respect of any substantial changes in law and/or policy. And it's been practiced that the same is required by national government in the form of socioeconomic impact assessments, known as SIAs. The differences between the two are only technical in nature. However, they both provide, a similar evidentiary burden requiring an assessment of impact to be undertaken with potential unintended consequences considered. It does not appear that this was done in respect of any recent version of this bill, And if it was, these assessments haven't been made, you know, publicly available, which, you know, would defeat the purpose altogether. I understand the Publishers Association of South Africa, PASA, raised these concerns in 2022, noting in particular the bill's perceived unconstitutionality and non-compliance with international treaties. PASA, together with other professional and industry associations, made numerous attempts to demonstrate the impact of the bill on the industry as well as the broader South African economy. While a CEO report was compiled in 2017, that document didn't appear to have any properly compiled under the CEO guidelines, failing to outline a clear assessment of economic impacts that the bill will or might have on the different strata of stakeholders within South Africa. PASA accordingly commissioned PwC to undertake a study on the key provisions of the bill. The overall conclusion drawn from the study is that, you know, the bill will have substantial impacts on the South African economy.
My apologies, Benson. I think you must, as you move forward, you must ask Enrico to move with you.
To move?
Yes.
No problem. I will do that, Jay. Are we? Yeah, I'm on the PASA, slide, Enrico. As I was saying, Chair, a study was commissioned by PASA, commissioned to PwC, and they undertook a study on the key provisions of the bill where, you know, the main conclusions to be drawn from the study were that the bill will have substantial impacts on the publishing industry, with PwC estimating that the bill will lead to a 33% reduction in book sales and that the domestic publishing industry would lose 30% of its jobs. Next slide, Enrico. Well, it's vital that the current act be substantially revised to align with South Africa's international obligations. The above findings from the PwC study highlight the importance of some form of economic impact assessment, be it in the form of a RIA like we do in the Western Cape, or a SIA that's done nationally at national government level, to ascertain the unintended consequences of introducing the bill in its current form. We submit that, you know, there appears little point in pursuing legislation that seeks to offer, you know, vital social outcomes, but at the cost of economic expediency, with the latter obviously having a direct correlation to the social outcomes being sought. Next slide, Enrico. I will now be moving to our comments on the more specific clauses contained in the bill. So the first clause, which has been one of the most contentious, is Clause 15, which inserts a number of provisions starting with proposed Section 12A, which provides for general exceptions from copyright protection. The proposed section reduces the protection that a copyright owner has over his or her copyright. The upshot of the proposed Section 12A is that copyright owners will no longer be able to be remunerated for their work when it is used for purposes such as those contemplated in paragraphs A1-7. Further, the wording has been amended, broadening the scope of the purposes for which a work may be legitimately used. The current Section 12.1 of the Act provides for a closed list of purposes, while the proposed Section 12.A1 refers to purposes such as the following, with the use of such as, suggesting that this is a more open list, which is likely to lead to copyright owners not being able to, or not being remunerated where their work is used for purposes similar to those listed. We accordingly submit, you know, as a province, that the proposed Section 12A substantially limits the copyright owner's right to enjoyment of his or her property, which amounts to arbitrary deprivation of property as contemplated in Section 25.1 of the South African Constitution. You know, we saw in the South African Diamond case, you know, which was heard in the Concord, it was held that in order for there to be an infringement of Section 12.1, which deals with the right to property, firstly, the right or the question or the thing in question must be property. And we know from the Lawford Off Promotions case, also in the Concord, that intellectual property has been recognized as a constitutionally protectable property. Secondly, there must be deprivation which is substantial, i.e. the intrusion must be so extensive as to have a legally significant impact on the rights of the affected party. And then finally, the deprivation must be arbitrary, i.e. the depriving law does not provide sufficient reason for the deprivation, or the depriving law is procedurally unfair. The purpose, the purpose of the proposed legislation is presumably to provide access to copyright material without having to obtain the copyright owner's permission. However, the open list is far too wide, and the circumstances in which copyright work can be used in terms of this provision are imprecise, which are likely to lead to quite a great, quite a lot of uncertainty. The purpose of enhancing access to copyright material is not justified by the extent of the provision, with the effect of weakening the overall copyright protection that a copyright owner enjoys or is supposed to enjoy. Next slide, please, Enrico. Still on clause 15, we submit that proposed section 12A contravenes section 22 of the Constitution, which provides for citizens' right to choose their trade, occupation, or profession freely. In the same SA Diamond Producers case, the Concord held that if a legislative provision has a negative impact on the choice of trade, occupation, or profession, then the provision must be reasonable and justifiable in terms of the criterion listed in the limitations clause under section 36 of the Constitution. If a legislative provision makes the practice of a trade or profession so undesirable, difficult, or unprofitable that the choice to enter that trade or profession is limited, then section 22 of the Constitution is contravened. We accordingly submit that proposed section 12A contravenes section 22 in that its provisions are so onerous as to render the occupations of anyone who produces a work contemplated in the proposed section and who deals in copyright to be undesirable, difficult, or unprofitable. The provisions may unduly impinge a copyright owner's ability to make a living and thereby negatively affect the choice to pursue that occupation. Further, proposed section 12A violates section 22 of the Constitution because there's no apparent justification or rational reason for the provisions, and due to there being no available impact assessment, which I mentioned earlier, or I mentioned the importance of earlier, it's difficult to rely on any of the rights, the limitations of rights that are outlined in section 36(1) of the Constitution. So we see, ultimately we submit that section 12A is unconstitutional. Next slide, Enrico. Proposed section 12D. This provides for exceptions from copyright protection applicable to reproduction or educational, or for education and academic activities. The exception from copyright protection in education and academic activities also results in copyright owners being afforded far less protection, consequently limiting their right to benefit from their work. We submit that this amounts to a deprivation of property, which is again arbitrary as contemplated under section 25(1). For example, so I think the main issue is that there's not a lot of clarity as far as what, I think I just lost my place here. The purpose of the provision is quite importantly to, promote access to the copyright material for educational purposes. But the provision is so broad, it's way too broad, and it's likely to lead to, it's going to increase the likelihood, the way we see it, of being exploited. Outside of the perceived ambit of what the drafters may have intended. For example, the provision permits the copying of entire books or journals if the license to do so is not available from the copyright owner, collecting society, or an indigenous community on reasonable terms and conditions, where the book cannot be obtained at a price reasonably related to that normally charged in South Africa for comparable works. It's not defined in the actual bill what constitutes a reasonable price or reasonable terms, which again is, it gives grounds for uncertainty and it's going to be difficult to enforce essentially. These provisions can be interpreted very broadly and thus exploited, and it's ultimately our submission that the extent of the deprivation is not justified by the purpose of granting access to works for educational purposes and is therefore arbitrary and unconstitutional. Next slide, Enrico. Thank you. Moving to clause 22, which provides for the insertion of proposed section 19C, providing for general exceptions from copyright protection, specifically in respect of copyright work for libraries, archives, museums, and galleries. It's submitted that the exceptions regarding protection of copyright work for libraries, archives, museums, and galleries also constitute an arbitrary deprivation of property, as contemplated under Section 25.1. Proposed Section 19C3 provides for library, archive, museum, and gallery to provide temporary access to a copyright work to a user or another library. It's not clear what is meant by the word access. Proposed Section 19C9 permits a library, archive, museum, and gallery to make a copy of a copyright work for its own collection when the permission of a copyright owner, after a reasonable endeavor, cannot be obtained or when the work is not available by general trade or from the publisher themselves. It's not clear, again, you know, from the wording, what reasonable endeavor actually means, what it means to, you know, what it means to make reasonable endeavor to obtain permission. Does this mean that a reasonable endeavor was made to obtain permission when the copyright owner expressly forbade the copying of the work? Is that a reasonable endeavor, or does it mean that a reasonable endeavor was made to locate the copyright owner, whether or not it was successful or not? Ultimately, it's submitted that these provisions constitute a substantial loss of profit for copyright owners. Furthermore, they are far too broad and vague to support the purposes contemplated in the provisions, and the deprivation of the copyright owner's property is therefore, again, arbitrary. Many of our other issues, Chair and the committee, many of our other issues were, you know, of a more technical nature, you know, relating to language, drafting convention, etc. So I don't think it's necessary for me to take the committee through any of those. That said, I wanted to, you know, summarize very quickly what we put forward as the main issues, our main issues with this bill. Next slide, here we go. The three main issues that we have, the first being is the insertion of proposed sections 12A, 12D, and 19C of the bill, which we see as substantially limiting a copyright owner's right to enjoyment of his or her property, amounting to arbitrary deprivation of property, as contemplated under Section 25.1 of the Constitution. Secondly, we submit that, you know, Section 22 of the Constitution, which states that every citizen has, you know, the right to choose a trade, occupation, or profession freely, and that the practice of a trade, occupation, or profession is violated by Section 12A or the insertion of proposed Section 12A. And finally, I mean, this is an almost catch-all issue. I cannot emphasize enough just how, you know, the lack of a proper, comprehensive socioeconomic impact assessment will impinge on the legitimacy of this bill. As I said right at the beginning, Chair and Committee, there are many competing interests at stake here. To avoid a bill that's passed on sentiment or not, you know, a bill that's not, you know, practical or practicable, and that is lacking in, you know, the ability to enforce or enforceability, any decision on how the bill proceeds needs to be based on, you know, evidence, which can be found, you know, which can really only be gathered through a comprehensive socioeconomic impact assessment that would look at how the bill will impact on different segments of society, with a proper analysis of costs and benefits in the country as a whole. So it would allow us to almost, you know, weigh up the different interests involved and see what the best position is and what the least restrictive outcomes will be for the country, and obviously what the benefits that might accrue as well. I think I can end it off. I'm happy to conclude on that point, Chair. Thank you to you and the rest of the committee for listening.
Thank you, Benson, for the presentation on behalf of the Zimbabwe government. Let me ascertain from members as to whether is there any clarification question that they would want to pose to you, Ben. It looks like as it is of now, quite audible and quite understood by raising the competing interests that are at the center of the bill during your conversation. The arbitrary nature, that is the point that you raised, the lack of economic impact assessment, and also the violation of Section 22 of the Constitution. Those are the thrust of the issue that you have raised. Just one question from my side. The latest Concord judgment that was brought by the blind South Africa, which indicated that there is the current act is as constitutional so far as it does not accommodate their interests. What's your view with regard to that?
I think you'll struggle, Chair, to find anyone who might directly be affected by whether the bill is passed or not, whether they are on one side of the spectrum or on the other. I think everyone can agree that the current act needs to be amended. It's been a pressing need for a number of years now. So whether you're on one side of the spectrum as an artist or as a major corporation broadcasting or record label or an activist in the education sector, I think everyone can agree on the fact that the current act, there needs to be alignment between the current act and what changes have occurred, you know, with the digital era. And obviously, like I said in the beginning of the presentation, Chair, South Africa's international and ongoing international commitments. I think the only issue, Chair, is that there needs to be some kind of balance in terms of what the impact of the current bill will have and the extent of impact, actually. So, like I said, I think it'll be very difficult to keep everyone happy. And that's why I almost wanted to be the committee's, if I could choose one point in my presentation that, or our submission as a province, I think we need to undertake a comprehensive impact assessment to determine the impacts firstly, and also to almost weigh up which, what course is likelier to, you know, to reap the most benefits for South African society as a whole. So it's one thing to have, you know, to sort of compare or juxtapose economic interests versus social outcomes, but the two are interlinked. So you can't have, in my opinion, you can't have the social outcomes that we're looking to have, we're looking to produce with the bill, if it comes at the cost of, you know, being able to attract, you know, investment into the country and having a growing film sector, for example, with, you know, with companies like, you know, I'm not going to mention any names, but there's companies, major international streaming sites that are investing into the country. And that, you know, the idea is that, you know, if we're able to grow that base, then everyone is able to benefit, you know, to some extent. So it's about striking that balance between protecting and also creating an enabling environment, which is what our main, I think, plus should be. And I think the only way, Chair, for us to be able to do that is to have an assessment of what the actual impacts are going to be on the economy and society as a whole. So as we continue to almost, you know, go through the different phases of analyzing the provisions of the current bill, we need to almost be cognizant at every stage of development that, you know, who are we actually, what's the outcome that we're trying to produce here, you know, and that's where the unintended consequences come in as well, because you might have one outcome in mind, but the provision actually ends up producing a completely different outcome. So you know, the impact assessment that I mentioned allows us to at least map out what those potential unintended consequences might be and to make an informed decision before we proceed with whatever version of the bill or the provisions that are in the bill as they are now.
Thanks, Benson and Mr. Benson Kuno, on behalf of the Western Cape Provisional Government, for the presentation. I believe that members are comfortable and were quite clear in terms of your views. Let me, on behalf of the Select Committee, express a word of gratitude to you for the effort that you took in terms of responding to our invite and also enriching this process. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you very much, Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Chairperson?
Hello, Maria.
Hi, Chair. We've finally managed to get a hold of Riki Hake, and they've indicated that the person who's supposed to be making the presentation flight was delayed, which is why they were not ready. They still need to confirm with us because they wanted to know if they could maybe come in later on today, right at the end of the session. But what we have done is that we've asked the following to the presenters that are to follow, MultiChoice as well as the Copyright Coalition of South Africa and the South African Music Rights Organization, if they can also just start these sessions 50 minutes earlier, and they've agreed. So up next will be MultiChoice G.
Thank you, Maria, for that progressive intervention. Let's then invite Mr. Aynon Doyle and Colin Dlamini and Lara Kantor on behalf of the multi-choice to the floor. The podium is yours.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning to committee members. Chair, am I audible?
Very, very audible, Mr. Dlamini. We are. We can see you.
No, thank you, Chair. My name is Colin Dlamini. I'm the Group Executive for Corporate Affairs at Multiple Choice Group. Multiple Choice and Mnet welcome the opportunity to make the submissions on the bill. I will not hog the stage alone, Chair. I am joined by my colleagues, Thabo Makenete, who is the General Manager for Capital Regulatory Affairs, Lara Kantor, the General Manager for Mnet Regulatory, Aynon Doyle, Head of Policy Analysis and Research, and Ms. Wendy Rosenberg, Director of Enforcement Attendance. Chair, we will share some of the problems in the Copyright Amendment Bill in our presentation today, the urgent need to deal with internet piracy for us to keep up with the digital era, the key issues to be addressed in the Performance Protection Amendment Bill. Thereafter, we will then provide our concluding remarks. Just by way of introduction, Chair, to the members, MultiChoice is a proudly South African company which has been around for more than 35 years with a footprint in 50 countries across the African continent. 4 years ago, we unbundled from Nasdaq and we listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. We are now a proud level one BEE company with one of the most successful true BEE schemes, Putuma Nathiswa scheme. We employ thousands of South Africans across the film and television industry and the entire value chain. And as a broadcaster with significant investment in film and television production, we are both major investors and users of copyright. Therefore, the copyright framework is of critical importance to us. We agree with the majority of stakeholders, including the previous presenter who just spoke now, who all say that South Africa's copyright regime must be updated. We totally agree with that. And we also agree that the bill, with the bill's objectives. And it's important to note that broadcasters are operating in an increasingly difficult changing environment. We are facing immense pressure from regulation, international streaming platforms, and piracy, which is on the rise in South Africa. Therefore, it is essential that copyright is used to incentivize and reward creativity. It is clear to us that this bill in current form is likely to stifle investment in local television production and creativity. We are thankful for the chance to share our experience and highlight all that could be lost if the problems in the bill are not addressed. Now, Chair, for broadcasters, the vast majority of local productions are commissioned and paid for by broadcasters. We put up all the funding upfront and we take all the risk. So creating local television content boosts the local film and production industry and it creates opportunities for many, many role players in the sector, for writers, actors, producers, and numerous support positions. MultiChoice is proud to have developed over 20 proprietary local television channels across 10 markets in Africa. We also have a local audiovisual content library in Africa spanning over 69,000 hours. In 22 alone, MultiChoice produced 6,000 hours of local television content for African markets and invested in excess of 5 billion rand in local general entertainment and sports content. Why? Simply because we believe in our talent, the stories that they want to tell, and the need to take stories to the world. In 2021 and 2022, we partnered with the Eastern Cape Development Corporation. We filmed two seasons of Survivor South Africa in the Wild Coast during the COVID pandemic. And before Survivor was shot in the Eastern Cape, we normally used to film Survivor in many beautiful islands around the world, like in Fiji, for example. But this time we were deliberate about attracting investment and creating jobs, especially at a provincial level. And we brought the greatest game in the world to the home soil. As a result, we boosted the local economy by more than 28 million rand. We created 168 jobs for communities with more than 400,000 rand in donations to community organizations. If you can just imagine for a second, in just over 40 days, a young unemployed lady by the name of Yolanda from the Amagumube community, she generated an income of over 80,000 rand from catering food to the production crew and the contestants. And her brother, Mungezi, provided lighting systems and learned new skills from international experts that were on this production. This is only one production, which is an example of how local television content not only entertains audiences, but also brings a range of social and economic benefits to communities. Therefore, there is so much potential in this type of investment, and they could be replicated in other provinces if we have a sound corporate framework. Now, the fundamental question for the committee to consider, in our view, is whether the bills will promote or discourage investment in the creative sector. Unfortunately, in their present form, the bills will discourage investment. Many proposed new, rigid, and impractical rules will make it much, much harder to get content on air. We will take you through some of our key concerns on how we can fix these bills. Our proposal on how we can move forward on the bill is that the interest of investors and creators should not be seen as competing interests. We all want to see a thriving and sustainable local production sector. But to achieve this, we need an enabling legislative environment. In the current form, as I've said, these bills do not provide an enabling environment and will harm those it seeks to protect. That's the unintended consequences. We should de-link these two bills. The copyright bill, despite its admirable objective, has many problems. We have proposed key minimum amendments to address the problematic issues for the copyright amendment bill to progress. The performance protection bill is less problematic and requires a few amendments in specific instances. I will now hand over to my colleague, Ainen, to highlight those specific provisions and take us through those issues. Ainen, over to you.
Thanks, honorable members. Before moving on to the next slide, and with a focus on the copyright amendment bill, I think it's important to note that the question of here is the copyright act. It is not the Copyright Exception Act, nor is it the Copyright Protection Act. It's the Copyright Act.
My apology, Ainen. Just want to check with the members. My online is standing here, Mr. Ainen. Are you comfortable? Yes, it looks like Colin was quite audible enough. Can you again take the floor, Ainen?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me now? Speaking a bit louder.
Yes, I can hear you now. Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you, Chair. The name of the act is the Copyright Act. It is not the Copyright Exceptions Act, nor is it the Copyright User Protection Act. It is the Copyright Act. So what is copyright? It is a legal right established by and enforced by the state to protect the creators of work and the owners of copyright. The primary aim, whether the creator of work or the owner of copyright is a multi-million rand company or an individual, gives them control over their work and how it is used. Why should the state do so? As Colin mentioned, to be honest, because it's economic value derived. When one exploits this legal right, whether it's a creator or a third party, businesses are created, jobs are created, the local, the regional, and the national economy, and ultimately the product of the country. Where those rights are not protected, where there is a lack of certainty around the use of copyright, is the loss of economic value in the price someone is paid for the work, which then leads to that a lack of business development, job losses, and harm to the economy. In general, as been mentioned by the presenters, the amendment bill does have a number of flaws, few of which this is unbalanced in favor of the open list of exceptions rather than a finite list of exceptions. When one looks at the visually impaired, that is one area where the current act is lacking. The Marrakesh Treaty, however, which proposed that the visually impaired be addressed, not be served as a blanket right. Once again, in a case where there are no accessible format copies available, and then the right is activated. When one looks at the hybrid fair use fee billing approach, I think as you mentioned before, it is likely to result in endless litigation. Let me propose child or fair use averages between 2,000 and 5,000 copyright infringements per annum. And that is why it is a distinct problem with approaching fair use as currently is being sold. But when we look at the broadcasting sector specifically, one of our key concerns the one-size-fits-all approach of the bill. The bill proposes this approach, which is very unsuitable for the creative world in general and television, based on recommendations from the Farland Commission. One should be bear in mind that the Farland Commission only focused on music rights and problems, contracts, and issues in regards to music rights. And from a single area, provisions in this act have been extrapolated, which affect all other sectors, film, films, graphic design, the publishing sector. There's no concern for the disruption in the value chain in those sectors. Not to mention, no regulatory impact assessments or socioeconomic assessments are done for impact in all those sectors, whether it be at provincial or national level. The law has given the minister very wide, vague, and unspecified powers to prescribe compulsory, which means, and standard and norm for an average, contractual terms to be included in those agreements. The minister is empowered to write these contract terms, which parties would have no right but to adhere to, regardless of whether they are appropriate for their context or circumstances. It also proposes a set of royalty rates and tariffs, with no regard to the fact that there are other ways of remunerating parties other than royalty. But what causes a constitutional concern is that the bill gives no guidance to the minister to take its unfettered power on what should be in the or how these royalties should be determined. And this is what makes it unconstitutional and makes the bill itself vulnerable to legal challenge, thereby causing any further delay. The other concern is that these provisions are also very highly impractical. Determination of royalty rates and tariffs are into very contractual negotiations in the vision. And those negotiations are very complex, nuanced, and complex specific. They're not very suited for a one-size-fits-all approach. For example, a lead performing the work could have a flaw in a season one contract that creates a basis season based on the performance of one. And there are a wide range of performance, experts, voice actors, need performance, a drama, performances in a music video, appearances in an advert, reality content, contestants, etc. How does the minister take consideration of all of these standard tariff and royalty rates. Standard contracts are not appropriate for the sector. It will slow down the pace at which something can be produced. Questions to ask is, how will the minister's service cater for all the different types of copyright work, such as script, music compositions, performances, audiovisual content, which span adverts, documentaries, films, TV, animation? How can standard contracts reflect the nuances of production? It's not possible for the minister to differentiate between an established star who would be rightly paid more versus an unknown newcomer. It's also important to mention, from an international perspective, Hollywood itself doesn't work fully to government staff contracts. So the standard contracts and rates are likely to deter investors. Once again, each production is unique. Even we have content of a production is the same, we have different tasks, different investors, different funding models, different locations, different audio, different source material, different music. And I could go on and on. This is why parties must have the freedom to negotiate their own agreement to address the unique nature of each production. But I think we can all say we appreciate what it is the book is trying to do, being unfair contracts in the creative industry. But rather than give the minister a wide and unfettered power to decide how everyone should do business, it is proposed the bill should rather which allows unfair terms of contracts to expire. Therefore propose that provisions giving the minister the power to set contract terms and prescribe royalty rates or tariffs from a copyright policy. Then one should look at how the tribunal itself could be empowered to set aside contractual terms that are manifestly unjust and unreasonable. Bear in mind that if the tribunal in such a case were to make a single ruling on an unfair term, it would apply to all contracts. An additional advantage creates uncertainty around contracts. It also allows the role today a flexibility to negotiate deals that suit the unique nature of production, at the same time safeguarding against unscrupulous terms, which is what is the intention of the legislature. Maybe proposal in this regard, which we have to find is part of our submission. Another area in the law, which also relates to contractors, is that section 39B of the law wants to make certain contractual terms unenforceable. Once again, we appreciate that the law is trying to ensure that the particular rights which are now being introduced in this law to the Act to protect authors should not be capable of now. That is not the way that Section 39 currently stands. Provisions are loosely phrased and may have far-reaching unintended consequences. Right now, creators from commercializing their rights, even where they want a contract which might better protect their commercial interests. Bear in mind what we mentioned about the economic purpose of copyright at the beginning, so that the owners of copyright use, sell, or license a work for a third party. It makes no sense to restrain that service, which underlies why the legal right is created in the first place by the state. It is likely to cause considerable difficulty for all parties, including individuals and performers, who are trying to get the best deal that they can. Once again, we understand that the intention is to deal with unfairness and has to help to make Section 59B workable and equitable. We propose that it is amended to provide that a contractual term, once again, can be made unenforceable if the tribunal makes a finding that the term unfairly renounces a right or protection. And this way, it would allow the parties to renounce a right or protection in circumstances where they have received an equitable communication. And we have made our proposals in this regard now written. Another key issue is that performing issues not being in the copyright law. Copyright law has conferred protection rights on performers, but it overlaps the issue of performers protecting the use of. Should likely to cause confusion, duplication, and likely litigation in the future when one has a problem of conflict with acts that came out at the same time. And one way that it causes conflict is the owning of royalty. Unlike the performance law, which in line with the Beijing Treaty, addresses both royalty and technical remuneration. We support the appropriate initiatives to ensure the fair remuneration of performers. The concerns about audiovisual performers not being paid fairly can be better dealt with through performance. It does allow more flexible alternative remuneration methods to exist. Performance protection bill is just appropriate statutory instrument to deal with performance rights, and it already does so. Therefore, we propose to remove the performance protection from the copyright bill and keep them ready in the performance. Alternatively, if these provisions are retained in the copyright bill, they must be amended to reduce the confusion and duplication of the performance protection amendment bill and to provide for royalties or equitable remuneration as the performance amendment bill currently does for written terms of the bill. One of the big concerns of the bill is that intercompany is not dealt with at all. Very surprising, because internet piracy is a global threat to the copyright industry, and everyone in the tech chain has it. Revenue leakage from piracy negatively impacts everyone along the value chain. Different services and technology have come into being, well, since 1978, and even now, since this bill was initiated. Different services and technology, live streaming, employed by pirates, are not being addressed. A key example, when a live broadcast of a CSL soccer match is streamed by pirates, the harm is immediate. It falls down the value chain. It broadcasts through advertising, sports associations, and in the play. It can't be dealt with 24 hours later by removal of a stream. It requires preventive action. And it's very concerning that this is not being addressed in the bill. We are decades behind those developments. Problems in dealing with internet piracy require urgent legislative attention, and at a bare minimum, the bill should include provisions for a streamlined cross-track proposal for the removal, takedown, and site blocking of people without the need to approach force to protect everyone in the value chain. Having included fairly extensive proposals in this regard in our written submission. I'll now hand over to my guest, Laura Cantor, to address some concerns on the performance protection.
Chair, good afternoon. Good afternoon to the committee. I hope that my audio is a little clearer than Anand's.
Yes, this is much clearer.
Thank you, Chair. I think we're about to be load shed here at the office, so if I disappear for a few seconds, that is why, but I hope that the generators will kick in and you won't use me for too long. So I'm going to talk briefly on our comments on the Performance Protection Amendment Bill, and our comments on this bill are a little different to our comments on the Copyright Bill. And then you can move to the next slide. Our comments on this bill are a little different to our comments on the Copyright Bill because we believe that this bill is less problematic and it's broadly in line with the applicable treaties. So we therefore think that this bill could, with some important but manageable amendments, proceed to finalisation. So Chair, we're all aware we don't have a lot of time today, so we're just going to highlight two matters in the Performers Bill, which we think require urgent attention in order for the bill to proceed. The first issue is the need to make the reporting requirements and the fines that are associated with those requirements more reasonable. And the second issue is this issue of how to ensure fair contractual terms for performers, but to do so in a way that doesn't impose a one-size-fits-all approach, which we really believe strongly that one-size-fits-all approach won't work for our industry. So turning first, excuse me, to this issue of reporting requirements, What the bill does is it sets new requirements for broadcasters to register and report on every broadcast of a performance and provide such report to every performer concerned. Now, we believe that this provision is really so irrational and burdensome that it's going to be practically impossible to comply with. For instance, the proposal doesn't take into account the huge volume of content that we're concerned with. The MultiChoice is just one broadcaster. We broadcast over 150 channels. This would result in almost 5 million broadcasts of individual performances every month needing to be registered and reported on. And it would obviously be even higher for on-demand platforms such as Showmax. So we believe, really, that this new section is so unduly burdensome that it's unlikely to pass constitutional muster. And we're also a bit concerned that the provisions are actually unnecessary, because when you think about it, for a performance to be broadcast, the performer would have already entered into an agreement with the copyright owner, and that agreement would set out the remuneration to which that performer is entitled. So it's unclear to us why we need to create such an onerous registration and reporting regime. In our view, the bill is really just imposing a massive administrative burden on users and even on performers who at the end of the day are going to be swamped with paperwork. The fines for non-compliance with the reporting requirements are also problematic. So the bill proposes a minimum fine of 10% of annual turnover. And in our view, this is far too high for failing to submit a report or submitting a report a bit late. And it's also unclear to us why failing to submit a report should be a criminal offence. The penalties also far exceed those fines set out in the Act for parties who have actively infringed copyright, which is obviously far more serious. In fact, they even exceed the fines set out in the Competition Act, where the maximum fine for prohibited cartel conduct is 10% of turnover. It's our strong submission that a fine must be proportionate to the severity of the act, and in our view, these fines are so unreasonable and irrational that, once again, they're unlikely to pass constitutional muster. Now, Chair, as you've heard throughout our presentation, we didn't want to come here today and point out the problems only. We wanted to give you some ideas on how the problems can be fixed. And we think, in some ways, they can be fixed quite easily. So on this issue of reporting requirements, we support the principle that performers must have equitable remuneration in respect of their works and should have visibility in how their performances are used. And we understand that that is what the bill is trying to achieve, but we think there's a better way of doing it. So instead of requiring these onerous reporting requirements currently in the bill, we say that the bill should make a provision for the compilation of an annual usage report, which could then be provided within a reasonable time after being requested. And we also say there should obviously be no requirement for prior registration. On fines, we say the maximum fine should be 100,000 Rand and it should be left to the tribunal to determine the quantum. And shall again direct you to our drafting proposals that we've made in this regard. In terms of this issue of contractual terms, so like the copyright bill, this bill is also concerned with unfair contractual terms and how best to address them. Now, we've already explained that giving the minister unguided powers to set all contract terms is problematic, and we've taken you through why this one-size-fits-all approach is impractical and unworkable for the audiovisual industry, which is so highly collaborative and includes so many different types of works. In the context of the copyright bill, our solution was to empower the tribunal to deal with unfair contract terms. But in the context of this performance bill, we have a different solution. And here we propose that there is a role that can be played by the minister in the protection of performers. Our proposal for the performance bill is that it should empower the minister to prescribe a list of items which should be included in all agreements with performers. So, for example, the minister could direct that parties must agree on their respective rights and royalties or equitable remuneration, the method and timing of payments, the duration of the agreements, even a dispute resolution mechanism. But the minister should not specify what the agreements on rights is or what the royalty rate is to be paid. And that's a crucial distinction. So in terms of our proposal, the minister would be able to specify that the agreements deal with the issues that are of concern to performers. But the bill would also safeguard the flexibility of role players to negotiate freely and operate with minimal red tape, which is so important for investment in our sector. So we believe that our proposal is a win-win. It balances oversight with flexibility. And crucially, it also addresses the constitutional concerns regarding the minister's unfettered powers. And again, Chair, our drafting proposals are contained in our written submission, and we hope you'll find them helpful. And with that, I'm going to hand over to Colin to conclude our presentation.
Thank you, Lara. Thank you, Anan. And Chair, we are really thankful for the opportunity to comment on the bills, and we reiterate our support for their objectives. You've heard our constructive proposals from Anan and Lara, and we trust that you will consider them in your deliberations, and you will ensure that we have bills that promote investment in local television content and the broader creative sector, so we can create more opportunities for young women like Yolanda, in the example that I gave with Survivor, and the other 167 people who got jobs in the rural communities in the Wild Coast last year. We need to enable more of our stories to be told to the world, and for South Africans to continue enjoying more shows like The River, Empire, Real Housewives of Gqeberha, Umkhokha, and so much more. Much has been said about the long legislative process we've been involved in with these bills. Therefore, move forward, we implore the committee to de-link the two bills and rather implement certain key amendments which are critical for the two bills to progress. The copyright bill, despite its admirable objectives, is very problematic. We have proposed key minimum amendments to address the most problematic issues for the bills to progress. Whilst the Performance Protection Amendment Bill is manageable and less problematic and only requires a few amendments in specific instances. And let's not miss the opportunity to deal with piracy. The time is now to address internet piracy. We also refer you to our drafting proposals in Annex A of our written submission. And lastly, we leave you with this summary of minimum issues which, in our view, must be addressed for the two bills to progress. Thank you for this opportunity, Chair, and for listening to our presentation. We are happy to take any questions from yourself and the members of the committee.
Thank you, Colin and your team, for the comprehensive presentation that you have made. Particularly leaving us with minimum amendments that you have to assume that if they were to be addressed, there will be minimal disruption in moving forward. Thank you. Just one question from my side on the assertion that the introduction of fair royalties and fair use is in the best interest of the wider section of our community, and the fact that in countries like USA and the EU countries have a fair royalties and a fair use provision, and also exceptions that I get a sense that you also have a reservation about. The last one, the promotion of the progress of science and visual arts knowledge through a temporary monopoly for authors and creators to protect their works from uses might impact on their livelihoods. I think the key issue to me is how do you balance this? Because look, your starting point is that indeed there is a need. There is a need to review the Copyright Amendment Bill and the Performance Protectors Amendment Bill. But the challenge is the issues around decentralizing the work that you commission the producers. Obviously, I think a key to us is the chain, is the supply chain between the producer and performers and others. Because from your side, you commission the producers to produce a series, you see. How do you ensure that, given the concerns that you raised, but also how do you ensure that there is a broadening of the sector in a manner that confront the monopoly of the industry itself? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Very, very, very good question. And I understand that it comes from, you know, a good place, because you're trying to understand more about how our industry works and how we can make sure that it continues to thrive. And you have a very difficult task to work this, to create this balance and work this tightrope. But I'll hand over to my colleagues to just help me with the responses. So Ms. Wendy Rosenberg, the director at Worksmith, also joined us. She'll tackle this one.
Thank you, Chair, for that question. I think your answer shows a real wisdom, because what you're asking about is balance. And I think that's what MultiChoice has come here today to say, is that this is not about us versus them. This is how do you achieve the bold objective in a balanced way. So how do you protect everybody in the creative value chain in a way that doesn't destroy that value chain, so that there's nothing to actually reward creators with. So, for example, on fair use, we didn't deal with fair use in the time available, but I think the view is that fair use is actually an American concept which has been imported into South African legislation, and it is overbroad. So we have a fair dealing principle in our existing copyright legislation, and that works. And what we end up doing with sometimes good intention is have negative unintended consequences. So the one example which I think has been given earlier in this process is, what incentive would an author have to write a textbook, for example, if that textbook can just, under the fair use banner, be used by every single student? So authors have an immense value to add, but they will only add that value if they will be rewarded for that. And so I'm quite wary of the fair use proposals that have been introduced. I think they're an American import, and I don't think that they fit within the South African framework, and I think they'll have serious implications for the rewards and incentives that authors have to create. As regards your question, well, how do we achieve that balance? What MultiChoice's presentation has tried to do today is to say, we understand what we think we understand, what you're trying to achieve. Here's our concern. Our concern is about the how, because in how we seek to achieve certain objectives, we are destroying a lot of value in the pipeline. So precisely what MultiChoice has tried to do is to say, okay, we recognize that there are very serious problems with this legislation. How can we constructively help to achieve those objectives in a more achievable way? And so those minimum amendments that have been left with you are not rewriting the legislation. They are giving you very pointed provisions to say, tweak this, 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 and this. And by doing so, you will still protect authors and creators, but in a way that doesn't decimate the entire value chain. Because it takes a huge amount of risk and money to invest in a production that you don't even know if it'll work. So, for example, in that Survivor example in the Eastern Cape, you know, that's a tremendous example of what can be achieved. But that means will and finance and a lot of collaboration. You know, it's not just actors or script writers. You're looking at caterers and lighting and production and filming. There is so much that goes into one single production. And what we're saying is you've got to make it possible. You actually want to say to people, come and invest. Let's get our talent on screen. Let's grow the sector. And the only way in which you can do that is by fairly rewarding everyone in the value chain. And if I can, with your permission, Chair, just give one more example. One example is fit equitable remuneration. So at the moment, there are royalty provisions in both the copyright legislation and the performance legislation. We're not saying don't reward performers. Of course, they must be fairly remunerated. But what we're saying is, first take out the duplication. It doesn't belong in the copyright bill. It's already dealt with in the performance bill. And then provide for royalties or equitable remuneration. You're inserting three words, or equitable remuneration, while they're already in the performance bill. But in that way, you ensure that performers are equitably remunerated without unduly stifling people's flexibility to negotiate and agree on contracts that work for a particular context. I don't know if I've answered your question or if anyone else in the team would like to add to that.
Yeah, maybe just to come very quickly there on the fair use, fair dealing. It's not something we dealt with extensively in our written submission because we thought it had been dealt with by other parties and we wanted to concentrate on our sector. But I think one of the specific things to highlight is that the South African current copyright regime is a fair dealing one. And that is based off the British system, which is also fair dealing. So it reflects our historical development as a country to a certain extent, that our legal system is aligned with the British one. And that being said, the British system has been amended as well. It was amended to address Marrakesh Treaty to include on their narrow list of exceptions that are permitted the visually impaired. And it was amended again in 2014 to address text and data mining for specifically non-commercial purposes because of the developments around AI and data mining on the internet. So the concern is with the hybrid approach, the words such as gives a list, but that list has not been constricted to only those examples on the list. It's very wide. One would prefer from the perspective of legal certainty, which is what fair dealing does give you, it reduces the number of court cases to secure precedents, which we would have to go through over the next decade for sure, is to set those narrow exceptions, which is in line with what copyright's about, the legal right created by the state. But of course, one is aware why a number of proponents of fair use in South Africa are doing so, and that is because in South Africa, if you have a narrow list, what happens if the environment changes? Especially in the digital environment, it changes every 3 years. How do you address the developments of technology? And one way to do that and still keep a narrow list is to empower the minister to make regulations to add to the list, but that should be subject to the three-step list. So it shouldn't be overbroad. It shouldn't conflict with the normal exploitation of these rights, and it shouldn't prejudice the legitimate rights of the holder.
No, thank you for that response. Of course, just the last points from my side, it might be the response from you. The difference between the UK legal system and the American one is that the UK is a parliamentary. With UK Parliament is the law of the country, and with America, because the Constitution is the supreme law of the country, and that our country also, South Africa, it uses the constitutional democracy, which means the constitution is the supreme law of the country. So I guess that's where the evolution of fair dealing and fair use emanates from. And that difference, the distinction given the proximity between our system, I guess even the intellectual property regime somehow will make a reflection in terms of our departure from our historical friends because of the developments in our country, we are no longer a parliamentary system, which might explain the emphasis more on the right to dignity, the freedom of trade, but more than that, also the latest Concord judgment on brought by the Blind South Africa, it reflects the evolution from where we come from and where we are going. I must then take this opportunity on behalf of the Select Committee to express a word of gratitude to my choice team, led by Colin and the team, for putting us in a much more better position to understand the industry, the areas of concern, but more than that, the progressive manner in which you also said, look, these are the issues, but these are the minimum way to go. And on that note, have a wonderful afternoon as you continue to listen to various views from the public, which ultimately will play a critical role at the end of this process when we deliberate and adopt the report of the House. Thank you, Colin and the team. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jess. Let's then move to the next presenter, which will be the coalition, the Copyright Coalition of South Africa, led by Mr. Kamate and Dr. Joel Baloyi. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, members, and thanks for the opportunity that you have afforded us. As we also join with others to try and assist in this particular process, I'm just trying to share my screen. Can you confirm, members, if you can see the presentation?
Not yet.
Right, I'll try to do it one more time. It appears that the screen sharing has been disabled on my part. Yeah, maybe Ms. Mahamad can assist you.
Mr. Baloyi, my apologies. I gave the hosting rights to your colleague, but I will grant it to you as well.
Okay.
Here we go.
There you are. All right.
I'm just checking if all right. Are you able to see the document? Oh, sorry. I think I need to click on share now. Is it visible now?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Once more, I want to thank our honorable members for affording us this particular opportunity. I'm speaking representing the Copyright Coalition of South Africa. Just a bit of my background. My interest in copyright really arose from my involvement in the industries where I have been involved for some time, including occupying key roles in the industry. And I've also been involved from the perspective of my academic involvement. And this interest led me to actually writing the first comprehensive doctoral thesis on music copyright in particular in South Africa. I just wanted to provide that background. So I'm representing the Copyright Coalition, which is really a coalition of various stakeholders in the copyright industry, spanning the publishing, music, film, other creative industries. And it involves several parties, including FASA, Animation SA, Audio Militia, Capasso, and all these entities that are mentioned here, which really makes it a broad church in terms of representing the rights of entities and persons who have an interest in copyright and the performance protection. The various parties would have themselves made their own presentations, and we do not regurgitate those. What we are aiming to do is really to present an overview from a conceptual perspective in terms of highlighting the principal issues that are critical relating to these particular bills. It has been said that the general position is that there are less issues generally with the Performance Protection Amendment Bill as there are with the Copyright Bill. And that's also the position that we hold. Now, I just thought that I'll start by, there might be some car enthusiasts amongst us, just to say that, it's a picture of a very nice car and be a dream car for some. I just give another side to it. Very, very nice car indeed. But what if I told you that this car actually, was something like this? It actually failed an accident test, a crash test, and it was then, someone just then came along and started to rebuild it into that car, and to present to you that this, in our view, is actually what is being presented to us, to the country, in respect of these pieces of legislation that are being presented. It's an instrument that has failed a crash test, a salvage car in a sense, and we are saying that this country deserves a better deal than that. I'm just gonna highlight, go through some of what we call those crash test points relating to this bill, those fundamental conceptual issues that are very critical to ensure that any legislation to be able to function and be able to achieve the objectives which it purports to achieve. And we are highlighting a number of issues here, basically three main areas: the faulty foundational and conceptual premise of these legislations, as I said, particularly the copyright bill. The emphasis on users' rights and users' rights protection. This particular expression, users' rights, was very clear in the very first iteration of this legislation or this bill, where it specifically highlighted the fact that the bill aims to protect users' rights as well as author's rights and the like. And that was removed as a result of a number of engagements. But we are saying that the essence of that particular approach has not been removed from the whole infrastructure of the bills. And we say it's as a result of a refusal to consult with experts who actually have an understanding of industry matters and how the industry works, including the very stakeholders who are involved in the day-to-day issues that relate to the industry and are affected by any legislation that will be passed. And we are saying there's a disconnect in that regard between what is promised in the bill and the actual offering in terms of whether these bills will be able to effectively achieve what is being promised. And there's also what we say a disregard of the advice of the four technical experts that had been appointed by the Portfolio Committee in the National Assembly to assist with highlighting important issues relating to compliance of the bill with the Constitution as well as the international treaties. I happen to be one of those, and we highlighted certain areas. And it's very interesting that in the Constitutional Court judgment in the Blind SA, some of the issues that we had highlighted, the court had actually confirmed. And we're saying, number two, there was no proper consultation. So inadequate consultation of affected rights holder groups. And then this therefore then leads to us then concluding that there could never have been a proper process of aligning the legislation with the three-step test that is required in international law, because you can only say that you have aligned with that if you have actually done specific studies that actually assist in determining that process. So now again we say there was a biased consultation of certain pro-bill advocates, and we have highlighted this issue several times that there was consultation, but it was very specific to those who had views that actually were in support of the bill, very intentionally excluding those that do not have those kinds of views, which we think is biased and it's not correct. And thirdly, that the fact that the bills were referred back by the president is no mean issue. It's a serious issue. It's an issue that should really make everyone, and including Parliament, really want to seriously engage in the issues, because it's an uncommon issue, and it involves a constitutional process. And I know that the fact that we are here today is as a result of agreeing with aspects of what the president had raised, but there are certain fundamental issues that were raised relating to the issues around constitutionality and international law that still remain glaring. And so we say that by and large, what has been done through all those different iterations of the bills is really a panel beating approach used to respond to the issues to try and salvage these locomotives that failed a car crash test, rather than presenting us with a robust original legislation that will be able to address the issues. Now, when we talk about looking at foundational issues and conceptual issues, we refer to the fact that in its conceptual framework and in the international law framework, copyright is seen as an author's rights system, not a user's rights system. This we find in the very first legislation of copyright, the Statute of Aim. It referred to encouraging protection for the rights of authors, and it was very clear in that particular legislation. It was then reflected in international copyright treaties, which are still applicable today, beginning with the Berne Convention, which recognized copyright as an author's rights system. This was confirmed in the Canadian case, Teledirect, where they say that the Berne Convention fundamentally seeks to protect the droit de tuteur, which is the author's right. Then we see this also in Article 1 of the Berne Convention. The countries to which this convention applies constitute a union for the protection of the rights of authors in their literary and artistic works, carried over into other treaties, this very same approach. However, at least from the 1990s, a narrative began to develop that started challenging the international consensus as to the nature of copyright as an author's rights system, whereby it was then postulated that, this is not just an author's rights system, it is as much a user's rights system as it is an author's rights system. And this then has led to a very strong lobby to push for the normalization of what we call an expansive regime of open-ended exceptions and limitations in copyright. Because if you say that this is as much a user's rights system as it is an author's rights system, then you are justified in saying that you can then impose within the system open-ended exceptions. So exceptions that know no limit. Which is actually very ironic because we're talking about limitations to a system. and exceptions that do not conform to the three-step test that is required in international law whenever the exceptions and limitations are to be introduced. And some rely on a dictum in a Canadian case in 2004, CCHA, Canadian LGBT versus Law Society of Upper Canada, where they, you know, made reference to copyright exceptions being a user's right. But as I said, it was just one odd instance. Why it matters is because our own constitution, Section 39.1, very clearly enjoins our courts whenever interpreting the Bill of Rights, which include the rights of authors, copyright, which is in essence a property right, that in doing so, they must consider international law. They may consider foreign law, but they must consider international law. Section 233 then clearly indicating that whenever interpreting any legislation, every court must prefer any reasonable interpretation of the legislation that is consistent with international law over any alternative interpretation that is inconsistent. And then talking about that, let's look clearly now at the international law position, because the Constitution says the courts must apply international law. The international law position is that copyright is an author's right system. The international law position is that copyright is an exclusive right and may only be interfered with by obtaining prior authorization from the copyright owner or at the expiry of the term of copyright or through a system of exceptions and limitations. But that system of exceptions and limitations in international law has to conform to the so-called three-step test, which means that it must only be done in certain special cases. Now, when you have an open-ended exception that says exceptions such as, you are not closing that. You are opening it broadly without any limitation. And in this case, the three-step test says in certain special cases that do not conflict with a normal exploitation of the work and that do not unreasonably prejudice the legitimate interest of the author. An alternative interpretation of constitutional law, which is inconsistent with international law, as we saw in Section 233, is one that says that copyright is a user's right system. That is an alternative interpretation, members, because the international the treaty system is clear that copyright is an author's right system, not a user's right system. Let's look at the foreign law position, which the court, the Constitution says the courts may consider. They don't have to. And in this regard, we find the fair use system that derives from the USA, the foreign law policy or system, that the courts may consider don't have to. And I mentioned the case of MoneyWeb versus Media 24, which was the first case where our courts were engaged with them, looking at the issue of fair billing. And this is what Berger J. observed in this case. He says, both sides referred me to decisions and writing from several foreign jurisdictions on the meaning of the phrase fair dealing. I understand that foreign authorities are referred to for guidance only. I also accept that I must be cautious in considering foreign law because each jurisdiction has its own particular history and in many cases is bound or influenced by domestic statutory precepts. I therefore intend, for historical reasons, to focus on English authority. That was a reason for historical reasons, for certainty, and in line with our system of legal precedent, that the court felt that it was better and more and proper to rely on you know, of English law authority rather than a foreign legal authority that you know, does not talk to our history and background, and which has applied that particular system of fair use for a period of over 200 years with a very complex jurisdiction that you know, would require our courts to really go through a lot of trouble in trying to make sense of that jurisdiction. Now, more on consultation. Parliament itself has said consultation is very important. It has to facilitate public participation, and it says in all aspects of a bill. When it says in all aspects of a bill, it means we cannot walk, you know, just paper through the cracks. We have to look at each provision of a bill and see how does it impact
the industry that it's supposed to protect in terms of the three-step test. That was the decision of the court in the Minister of Health case. And it went further to say that such consultation must ensure that a reasonable opportunity is offered to members of the public and all interested parties to know about the issues and to have an adequate say. When we're hearing a lot of the representatives from industry say we were not properly consulted, that has to be taken seriously in light of this decision. In Doctors for Life case, the court there highlighted the importance of the consultation process for ensuring the crafting of effective laws, and I highlighted that because it's important, and held that the process of public participation in legislative processes is calculated to produce laws that are likely to be widely accepted and effective in practice. And that is a very key phrase, Chair, there, that the laws have to be effective in practice, rather than just being theoretically so. We're saying without a proper consultation with stakeholders on the socio-economic impact of the bills based on the prior compliance process, the resultant legislation will be defective and cannot be said to have met the international law requirement of a three-step test prior to introducing the exceptions and the limitations. Now, on the socio-economic impact assessment system, this is a system introduced by government itself, 2015, to replace the regulatory impact system. Its aims are to ensure that the policy is on the right track by requiring evaluation of alternative approaches to help drafters avoid finalizing an inappropriate solution because they move too quickly to select a strategy to facilitate a brainstorm of the issues involved in the problem and the full range of alternatives to deal with them. It entails identifying the problem, the affected groups, and how they are affected. And in this way, it gives effect to the three-step test requirement in international law. But this was not done in the current process. Now, let's go to Blind SA, which is a very important decision. The decision has actually provided us with a preview of how the Constitutional Court or the courts are likely to treat the current bills if they are presented to that court, if a constitutional challenge is mounted. Importantly, the judgment has highlighted the fact that the court shuns a hostile users' rights aligned view on copyright. That's what the court highlighted there, because the court was very clear that it wanted to provide an effective interim relief to Blind SA in such a way that as to respect the rights of copyright owners. That was clear in paragraph 105 of that judgment. The court furthermore took an approach that views exceptions and limitations as targeted relief. The court called exceptions and limitations targeted relief. The court said that this is such, that is, in explaining what that means, they said it is such a relief as must be formulated to protect the rights of copyright owners. Again, in paragraph 107, that's what the court said. It says targeted relief. The court was careful to ensure that the exceptions and limitations regime should not prejudice the legitimate interests of rights holders. In other words, the court ensured a three-step approach to its decision. Furthermore, the court was careful to ensure that the relief granted to Blind SA aligns with the dictates of the Marrakesh Treaty, and struck out the expansive provisions in that bill that are not provided for in the Marrakesh Treaty. Now, targeted relief to me means that it's relief that aims at specific cases, aligns with the three-step test that says only in special cases. It is an approach that is very much alien to the fair use approach that is free for all, that provides for open-ended exceptions that do not mention specific cases. The Concord said targeted relief, and that is important in determining this issue to consider that. And the other thing, what we had highlighted in our opinions, in the expert opinions, that we have to align with what the Marrakesh Treaty says in terms of the protections that must be provided. The Concord confirmed that position. So this is very much important. And we say the fact that relief that is sought must reference, they said here in the bill, it says, the exception applies to all works. They say, no, Marrakesh says it's limited to literary works. So you must limit it to literary works. And you cannot refer to persons with disability. You have to say, you know, persons with visual and pain disabilities. That's what Marrakesh provides for. And then they say you must define beneficiary person so that it's clear what that means. That is in line with Marrakesh. That is the approach of the Constitutional Court in this matter. And then we're saying there are a lot of other issues that we can talk about. I was clear from the beginning that we did not aim to mention or refer to specific cases, but just the principles. Others, including those that just came now, have highlighted specific areas. And I think we are in a difficult position because we have had all these people coming and mentioning a lot of things, but the issue is how do you then navigate all those? That is why we say it's important to go back to the drawing board in the sense of ensuring alignment with the three-step test. You cannot have a one-size-fits-all approach because you are dealing with different industries. You may have heard some mentioning certain things that to them are important, which may not be important to others. The best approach is, and that is even in the U.S., if you look at their legislation, they're very specific in terms of you know, the specific sectors and say, how would you approach it with respect to the music sector? How would you approach this in respect of the film sector? How would you approach this in respect of the literary rights sector? And how would you deal with the unique circumstances of vulnerable communities in terms of giving the exceptions? And we say this is the better approach. And to be able to do that, you must do an impact assessment study that looks into all those areas. There are some that have said that, well, Marrakesh says that you can extend these exceptions to beyond what Marrakesh says. It's true. I'm referring now to Article 11 of the Marrakesh Treaty. And that treaty, of course, does say that, you know, but it says you, in adopting these measures, you must make sure that you align with Article 92 of Bern Convention, three-step test. Article 13 of TRIPS Agreement, three-step test. Article 10.1 of WIPO Copyright Treaty, three-step test. Article 10.2 of the WIPO Copyright Treaty, three-step test. And then Article 10 says you could go beyond. You may implement in your law other copyright limitations and exceptions for the benefit of beneficiary persons than are provided by this treaty. However, you must do this having regard to the contracting party's economic situation, its social and cultural needs, and in conformity with that contracting party's international rights and obligations, which brings us to the three-step test in international law. I'll pause here and hand over to my colleague to present the SAMRO part. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Louis. So who's coming on board now?
It's me, Chairperson. Okay. Doc, I just need to stop sharing.
All right, I need to stop sharing. Just a moment. Is it possible for someone to stop the sharing? I'm finding it difficult.
Enrico, can you come to the rescue, Mr. Malloy?
What's that happening, Chairperson? In the interest of time, I just want to introduce myself. My name is Chola Makhamate. I wear two hats. One is the chairperson of the Copyright Coalition, and thanks to Dr. Boloi for making that presentation on our behalf. And my second hat is as the general manager for legal services at the Southern African Music Rights Organization, known as SAMRO. So I think before I present, just some issues in principle, I want to state that SAMRO and the coalition do support the objectives of amending the Copyright Act. It is an old piece of legislation, as one presenter previously highlighted, that needs to be brought into this decade, this century. Can you see my presentation, Chairperson and members?
Yes, we can see your presentation.
Okay. And we do support the amendment of the Copyright Act. It's necessary to bring it into what is happening in line with copyright use and copyright consumption of content and everything else that is happening within the creative industries space. We obviously, as SAMRO, operate within the music industry specifically. So we do support the amendment of the Act, but we do caution, however, that in amending the Act, you produce legislation that is fit for purpose and actually will not have unintended consequences that cause harm vis-a-vis the good that you intend to bring
to organizations like SAMRO and its members, and also the creative industries as a whole. Another thing to mention here, because I realized that in bringing us to this process, which has taken 14 years, as one of the presenters highlighted, the trigger was the Farlam Commission and in dealing with issues around the regulations of CMOs, which SAMRO is, and some of the issues that artists were complaining about in particular at the time. And I think I want to reiterate as a CMO, as SAMRO, that we do support the regulation of CMOs. And again, reiterating that the drafting of such regulations should be proper and should be done in a manner that does not cause, again, harm instead of the intended good. So we do support the regulation of CMOs in that regard. SAMRO is a CMO that administers performing rights for composers and authors. So from a practical perspective, SAMRO deals with the administration of copyright on a day-to-day basis. It is our work. Our job really is to step into the shoes of composers, authors, and publishers and act in their best interest from a perspective of ensuring that we collect licensing fees on their behalf and then pay over royalties to our members. We represent the interests of approximately 136,000 composers, publishers, and authors across South Africa. So we don't have a small number of members. We've actually got a large number of members across the country and also across the world through bilateral agreements with other sister organizations across the world in Europe, Australia, the States. So we have a fairly large footprint from that perspective, both locally and internationally in terms of our bilateral agreements. Now, I want to state here that we fully support the presentations that have been made previously, in particular by the South African Institute of Intellectual Property lawyers and also luminaries like Professor Owen Dean. And our presentation is not going to be an exposition necessarily of the law, but just give you a window into how the bills as they currently are going to impact not just as an organization, but our members who are beneficiaries of the work that we do on a day-to-day basis. Our stakeholders, Chairperson, are twofold primarily. We, as I've indicated, represent composers and authors, and on the other hand, we license users who include broadcasters, schools, municipalities, malls, restaurants, etc., etc. We ensure that licensees are paid in terms of the Copyright Act by these users so that we can then pay over royalties and distribute royalties to our members. This is in terms of what's been happening with the bill, just to bring this to your attention, is that because of the way the bills are currently drafted, they are proving to be problematic to us from a day-to-day basis, in that our users are now seeing the opportunity to refuse to comply with the Copyright Act as it stands, because they are seeing a situation where it's now tilting quite in favor of users' rights vis-a-vis composers or creators' rights. And that's really posing a challenge to us in terms of how we run our business. In terms of the rules of engagement with these stakeholders, currently it's quite clear. We have in our law fair dealing. Everybody understands what the rules of the game are. We understand, users understand that they need to check out a license in order to use our members' repertoire, and they need to pay a license fee, and they understand in which circumstances they can claim that they don't need to pay a license fee in order to use our members' works. I just want to state, Chairperson, that SAMRO is not opposed to exceptions. Exceptions are part and parcel of the copyright system. I think the issue that we have here is that the exceptions that are being introduced in the bill are overly broad. So what will happen is that the playing field will not be clear. We understand with fair dealing currently what we can and cannot do, what we cannot enforce with users with regards to compliance, and they also understand, and it's then easier to enforce compliance. What will happen with the fair use, in particular the fair use principle when it's introduced, is that the phrasing of the word such as opens up the field so widely that users will be able to use that as a defense in terms of using our members' works without getting permission or paying royalties or license fee, which then converts into royalties and payment to our users, because they will have this defense. And it will require us to take them to court in order to determine what if they have been copyright infringement on their part. So it really does open up this field widely in terms of what we can and cannot do going forward from a compliance perspective with regards to copyright legislation. Yes, the legislation needs to change, but what we have currently, and I think this has been reiterated by several speakers, is legal certainty. We know what the rules of the game are, whereas going forward, should this bill be passed in its current form, we won't know what the rules of the game are. We're also very concerned about this one-size-fits-all approach that has been taken with regards to the creative industries in particular and the Copyright Amendment Act. I think I mentioned earlier that the genesis of this was the Farlam Commission and the focus in particularly on the music sector, and that has now translated to the rules of the game, quote-unquote, for the music sector being applied across the board to other sectors within the creative industries. And that should not be the case, because music is impacted differently in terms of copyright, differently to the AV sector. It's, the book publishing sector or book writing sector is impacted differently. Animation is impacted differently. Software is impacted differently. So all these other sectors in the creative industries are impacted differently by the provisions of the Copyright Amendment Act, but there seems to have been a knee-jerk reaction to what was happening within the music industry, and therefore the rules there have been applied to the other industries. And if you don't use the analogy of sports, you would not use the rules for cricket and apply them to soccer or netball or hockey. You would use the rules for those particular sports and apply them accordingly. But what this act does, or the bill does, is that it takes the rules for cricket and then takes them to hockey or to soccer or to netball, whatever the case may be, which creates immense confusion. And then those industries are unable to operate or will be unable to operate in a manner that is efficient. And then that will have downstream effects on the various value chains within those different industries. Just in terms of fair use, Jefferson, I say set amount of free use, purely because the rules of the game will not be clear. Users will be able to use works, in particular for family members, without having to pay a license fee. Therefore, downstream, our members will not derive the benefit of that use in terms of remuneration. It will also diminish the value of works, particularly South African works. You might as well just put a sign to users both here and internationally that says, open for business, come and take what you need. If somebody challenges you, use the deep pockets that you have to ensure that you drag them through the court system. That's essentially what will happen. I mean, the other analogy is, imagine if you go to a soccer game, and we all know what the rules are. We all know when there's a foul, we all know when there's a penalty, and the referee is very clear about when that's supposed to happen. But then you come and introduce something which you have basically transplanted from a foreign legislation, and you go to the soccer game, and nobody knows when there's a foul, nobody knows when there's a penalty, and in order to determine that, you need to go to the courts to make a determination about what that happens. That will stifle the creative industries. That will stifle an organization like SAMNO. We won't be able to act in the best interest of our members, and they won't be able to get the remuneration that they need to get. Another issue is that there are no, whereas with the US legislation, they have punitive damages in the event that somebody does win an infringement case, but this has not been imported in our law. And I think you've asked the question with regards to fair use. It is an important doctrine from the US, but I think what our legislators have done, our drafters have done, which is quite dangerous, is that they've gone even further. They've supercharged what fair use is and are trying to import that into our legislation. So you have this supercharged fair use. You have a situation where people don't know what the rules of the game are. You have a situation where creatives will not be able to derive the benefits of the creation of their work. They won't be able to make money. Simply put, they won't be able to do things like put food on the table. And the, one of the objectives that, one of the things that the bill was meant to deal with was the issue of artists dying paupers. I'm afraid, Jefferson, with the way the bill is currently drafted, that is going to continue and will actually become a lot worse. It won't fix the problem, it'll make it much worse, because now you're placing the onus on a lot of predominantly black creatives to go to court and prove that there's been an infringement. I don't know how many people have the funds to actually do that, and that's where also organizations like SAMRO do step in, because we do step into the shoes of our members and they're able to litigate on matters. But even then, we don't have an endless litigation budget, and at some point we'll have to pick and choose our battles. But what will eventually end up happening is that the value of South African creative content will be diminished, because nobody will feel the need to pay what is required in order to remunerate our creatives. Like I said, I'm not going to go into details about the specific provisions, but I have mentioned them briefly here in my presentation. We did make a detailed presentation to the committee and submitted it to the Secretariat, which does provide a lot more detail in terms of SAMRO's position. But what we want to say in conclusion, Chairperson, is the importance of a socio-economic impact assessment study cannot be underscored. It is critical in this process to determine how these provisions will impact the various sectors in the creative industry. Music will be impacted differently. Audiovisual will be impacted differently. Animation will be impacted differently. Books will be impacted differently. And you can't apply the same provisions across the board. It will create chaos. It will just create anarchy. You know, South Africa will become like some sort of Uber Eats or sorts, where people will just log on and then pick and choose what they wanted and pick the best deal for themselves that adequately remunerating those that need to be remunerated. So that is something that I implore the committee to do. Again, have a sector-based approach, given the various consequences to the sectors because of the different impacts on the different sectors, and also base the drafting on proper IP policy. We've heard a lot of recommendations, we've heard a lot of assertions about what should and shouldn't be in the bill, but I've yet to hear what this has been based on. What IP policy in our country is this based on? We need to have an answer for that, because otherwise, a lot of these recommendations are some of them on an emotional basis, some of them ego-driven, some of them we don't know what the justification is, but we need to have, in order to remove all of that, you need to have an objective standard against which you are applying, and a proper IP policy and an impact assessment study would assist in going a long way, and also utilize the advice given by the experts previously that were appointed by the Portfolio Committee in the National Assembly. They gave cogent advice, but in the drafts that have appeared since, we have not seen that coming through, and it still appears very much a user-based draft of the Copyright Amendment Bill. And just something that I've not put here, also, we implore you to look at the issues around piracy. It's a huge issue, particularly for our members. Their content is being exploited online on various different sites that pop up every day that are being controlled in jurisdictions across the world. And that's something that needs to be dealt with seriously, but it's absent in the bills. And I implore you to look at that. Chairperson, and I just want to thank you for this time that you've taken to listen to both myself and Dr. Baloyi, and we hope that you take our input into consideration. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Makamate and Dr. Baloyi, for taking the committee through a very detailed and comprehensive presentation, punctuated by metaphors over the week to illustrate the foundation upon which the two bills as aspect were anchored. Other than that, let me check with the members as to any point that they want to raise. I guess they are quite happy with what you have presented. I think the point that are you correct to say the bill was driven or what?
No, I think, Chairperson, I'm just being facetious. I think in instances where, because this is, it's very historic. If you look at the history as well with this bill, it's been a fairly divisive bill with inputs coming from very pro and very anti the bills. I was just being facetious in the sense that I think it's a naming process as well. So they might be those motivations.
I think we got the gist of what you're saying. I think the point is definitely there is a need to amend the law. But I think key to the issues that we are raising is the absence of policy. That's what I got from you. That the intellectual property policy preceding this bill is an area that you have an issue with. The expert advice that was commissioned, your view is that to a larger degree it was not considered. I think that's what I was saying. But also, also the issue of the one size fits all. You are saying that the music, the impact, the Bollywood impact differently on music, on software, on number of areas that you have highlighted. But I think what would be quite critical from our side is just to accept the fact that indeed you have helped us a lot in terms of particularly from the Sambo side. There are a number of areas that you are raising, but also the Dr. Baloyi has also highlighted key areas that we need to take into account as we engage here with this process. Going forward, we will definitely take into some of the issues that you have raised. It has helped us a great deal as a community to sort of get a sense in terms of where you come from. I think the issue of the users versus the author, the evolution of the law in terms of point of emphasis or the tempo, whether the emphasis on the user's right or is it on the copyright owners. I think that's what Dr. Baloyi right at the beginning indicated. But I think what is quite critical is the fact that there is a need that you have identified, but the biggest challenge that you are saying, Mr. Mahamat, is that the Falun Commission was more on music, so we took those recommendations to apply it across the board. I think that's the sense that one got. Yes. But other than that, I think we are happy for the presentation that you have made. Allow me to take this opportunity on behalf of the Senate committee to extend a word of gratitude to you and wish you a wonderful afternoon as we continue with our discussion. And just to the members, understand that we stick to the time and then leave adjourn the meeting for lunch until 10 past 2, and then we'll kickstart at 10 past 2, because some of the presenters that we have are from abroad, and therefore we cannot tamper with the program expertise as it was crafted in a manner that will take into account some of the audiences from abroad. Thank you,
Mr. Makamati. Chief, just a correction. The second session was at 2 o'clock, Chief. It was at 2 o'clock. Yes.
Okay. We are there. Let's start at 2 o'clock exactly. Thank you, Dr. Baloyi. Thank you, Mr. Makamati.
Thank you, Jeff.
The meeting is adjourned.